This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Entik. We are collaborating with Mercy Malaysia on a series of shows about humanitarian development. This week, Hafiz Amirul, head of Building Resilient Communities at Mercy, is here to explain a recent consensus among international humanitarian aid circles to make peace an essential component to the delivery of aid. It's called the Triple Nexus. Hafiz Amirul, welcome. If I can start with the concept itself, how would you explain what the Triple Nexus is?
Thank you. Let me first define the word nexus. In Latin, nexus means to link or bind together. Where a nexus is where different things converge naturally or by design, a point at which they come together organically or deliberately join up and tie together. In the humanitarian sphere, maybe 10 years ago, decade ago, there's a divide, a gap between humanitarian action and development work. But in 2016, at the World Humanitarian Summit, a new way of working to transcend the humanitarian development divide was committed by the United Nations and those attending the conference. In global humanitarian policy today, there's a near universal conviction that we should join together different strategic goals, different strategic approaches and diverse fields of practice, both in the humanitarian action and development work as much as possible. This is because for the fact that things like hunger, conflict, food security, peace, resilience within communities are already causally linked together, and therefore they need to be addressed together.
What are the underlying assumptions that by linking all these issues together that we can have a better outcome?
The divide has put a separation between humanitarian action. It happens right after a disaster. But of course, in natural context, development still needs to go on. And development is going on even during or before the disaster. So humanitarian and development actions, they converge around the need to prevent, prepare, and to respond to crisis. Especially for the most vulnerable and at-risk populations. We have multi-annual publications, reports. For example, the humanitarian response plans published by the United Nations Office for Coordination of United Nations Office of for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, UNOCHA, which enables humanitarians to formulate responses to, for example, protracted crisis, and at the same time, complementing development issues designed to meet the 2030 Sustainable Development Goals. Right. So by linking them together, humanitarian actions could seamlessly be part or could seamlessly be continued to a more sustainable development for the specific locality of that area.
Can you give me an example of or a case study of how the Triple Nexus worked in practice?
Before I try to explain that, the Triple Nexus is quite a recent thing. So after the World Humanitarian Summit in 2016, they were talking about humanitarian and development nexus. And recently, they were talking about the possibility, or when needed, to also include peace building in the whole ecosystem. Because ultimately, peace is what we are aiming for, a safer world, more resilient world, which ultimately leads to peace. How they can be converged together, how can they coexist together is that, for example, in the context of work of Mercy Malaysia, we are mandated especially on providing medical relief and disaster aid, which also there are demands for sustainable health development, like psychosocial mental health and other developmental work like water, sanitation and hygiene, reconstruction, shelter, school building, and so on. These phases, they can be addressed strategically, specifically at each stage, because the need and demand of each stage is different, whether it is earthquake, flood, a war, or all kind of risk. They have specific demand and needs. So therefore, the transition between from humanitarian aid into sustainable development should be designed based on that contextual needs and with the aim of peace. So okay. That is how generally how I would put it as a vision.
So I think this is one criticism towards this triple nexus, which is maybe trying to do too many things at once, right? Providing aid is apolitical. Try to save as many lives as possible. That's the only metric. Whereas, I guess, development and peace building is a political process. And so is it not dangerous to make peace and or development a precondition for aid?
Yes, we are aware of that criticism, especially because humanitarian, it is very, I mean, the need is there, the high spirit of people involved is, which makes it almost free from any political intervention, while development is something different. It is much more complicated as an ecosystem. But the pressing question is that after natural disaster strikes or a conflict breaks out, how can humanitarian assistance transition smoothly to long-term development despite all the criticism? Because over the past two decades, this question has sparked considerable debate and research within the development circle. We got Puritans, humanitarian Puritans, and also development Puritans. This well-intentioned attempts to foster more sustainable and seamless integration between humanitarian and development in response to a crisis which has led to little tangible progress for the past 5 years, perhaps. So what we need is a well-thought-of, a well-coordinated, should I say, master plan to put all things together so that, of course, we are mandated to do certain things, but we have to look into the bigger picture of sustainable development, which ultimately would offer peace for people. But that criticism is something that I think we need to ponder upon, because not only that, one of the biggest challenge is funding, because, like I said, when disaster happen, I mean, funding is relatively quite easy to get, but the pressing needs of continuously assisting and developing a certain community so that they can sustain on themselves require sustainable development, in which funding is
harder to come in
comparing to humanitarian assistance. And this is where education is important. Education to donors, to funders, and education to local governments, state governments, and the general public, that we must not divide those two, because if we keep on doing the way that we used to do, I mean, disaster will keep on coming without building proper resilience, stronger resilience for a community, for a place. We'll be doing the same thing over and over again. And I don't think we were left with much choice but to address those despite all the criticism.
Yeah. Let me put it this way as well. Because each country operates under different political contexts, right? And so wouldn't a nexus like this, which makes it a requirement for development and peace, would that not contradict the humanitarian principle, which is to be neutral, impartial, as well as independent? Should we not leave the nitty-gritty of diplomacy and the politics of it to politicians and diplomats rather than humanitarian workers taking on that responsibility as well?
Well, if I'm speaking on behalf of my Malaysia experience and capacity for an organization that has been around for, we are 20 years old next year. It is much of the collective experience and the understanding towards needs and long-term development. Even though we still need to be abide by the key principles of humanitarian, which are humanity, impartiality, neutrality, and independence. But this is where the art of humanitarian actions plays its role, especially during the transition from humanitarian relief, disaster aid relief. And once you get into development, you have no other ways of working but to be working collaboratively with the specific government where you're working in. But at the same time, you have to stay impartial and apolitical. It is like a utopian vision of a peaceful world where no matter where you are working, under which government, under which political isms that the particular country or place is holding to, when it comes to humanitarian aid and also developmental work which are related to humanitarian needs, it has to put aside all those differences. The political divide and so on. It's not easy. It's not easy. But we have been doing that in, for example, in Malaysia, in Kelantan, which is of a different political rule. But it has shown, I mean, a good example that humanitarian work, which then leads to developmental work, can act as a very strong diplomacy tool. And of course, one of the challenges and one of the steps ahead that we are looking into are measures of humanitarian diplomacy, like what you mentioned just now.
So meaning if the government do not open up in some way or compromise in some ways to making some changes, then help is not able to come in?
Yeah, there are living examples like some of the further left behind countries, for example, Laos and other countries. But with proper data, proper engagement, starting from the lowest level of the community right into the upper level of decision makers, policy makers, and the government, it is possible. It is possible. Mm-hmm. For example, we are now looking into having this long-term building resilient community project in Myanmar, in the Chin state of Myanmar. Now, Chin state is, based on research, is the poorest state in the whole of Myanmar, with 73% of its population living under the poverty line index. We do face resistance from the local government, but that is not the end of the game. We believe that with proper data, analyzed data, and also with those good intention and with good planning, we will be able to work together with the local government for the sake of the community.
I'm speaking today to Hafiz Amirul from Mercy Malaysia about the triple nexus of humanitarian action. After the break, we'll discuss what it means for a community to be resilient. Don't go away, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Eun Teck. On the show with me today is Hafiz Amirul, Head of Building Resilient Communities at Mercy Malaysia. We're discussing the triple nexus in humanitarian action. Hafiz, last week, Mercy Malaysia's President Dr. Faizal Pedaus said that it's impossible to work in a place like Myanmar without the buy-in of the Burmese government. So because there is this need to interact with state actors, would it cause more NGOs who are not maybe as well-run as Mercy or well-funded as Mercy to avoid places where it's difficult to operate in and, you know, gravitate towards places where it's easier to provide relief? So in places where those who need aid the most would not receive most of it?
It's very true. I mean, we're quite lucky that we are, if I may say, more developed because of the age, maybe 20 years. But for smaller organization, it could be very hard for them to do things according to this triple nexus vision. But this is where good coordination would come, because you can't do everything by yourself. I mean, like Mercy Malaysia, we are mandated for, especially for health. When it comes to, for example, water and sanitation and hygiene, we require specialists. And we are very lucky that we have core volunteers who are geologists, water specialists, engineers, and so on. So the same goes to all these other NGOs, small NGOs, medium scale, large scale. We can't do everything on ourselves. So it's only through coordination and sharing of information and data, and through good network, is where it is possible to implement the Triple Nexus. Because this Triple Nexus thing is not about a particular NGO or a particular individual or organization. It is about the whole systematic approach in creating a sustainable ecosystem which would benefit the beneficiaries. So it comes hand in hand with coordination and networks.
Speaking of specialists, you are a trained architect. You also head the BRC unit in Mercy, the Building Resilient Communities. Tell me about this role, and at what point after disaster strikes does your team go into the front line?
Well, Building Resilient Community is a unit within Mercy Malaysia. After the Indian Ocean tsunami that hits Aceh, Thailand, so there's a pressing need on disaster risk reduction. We call it DRR. It is basically about educating, training communities, local leaders to be more prepared to face a disaster. But BRC was formed in 2015 after the World Conference on Disaster Risk Reduction in Sendai, Japan, which produces a framework that we use as guidelines, which is called the Sendai Framework for Disaster Risk Reduction. So BRC is it's a strategic move on how we can work together with five main components of a community, which include the local community themselves, local government, schools, which include teachers and school children, health service providers, clinics, hospitals, and also the private sector. So it is about tying all these main players, main actors in a community, so that the knowledge on DRR and also DRM, disaster risk management, can be disseminated in a more holistic way at a more targeted audience, and how these five components of a community can be well informed so that they can form a network on their own, with the objective of building a resilient community.
So getting all these public amenities up and running is your priority, to that the availability of those services would lead to resilience?
Part of. For example, this is very true for the hospitals, the health service providers and schools, because we need to make sure schools are safe and hospitals are safe and running even after a disaster, because we can't afford to have a non-functioning hospital. And also school, because, for example, in Malaysia, every time there's flood.
Or the case as well, right?
In schools.
Pollution.
So part of the function is to strengthen this critical infrastructure, maybe not structurally, not in an engineered way, but it could also be that way. But more on the educating of those stakeholders involved, so that they are more aware on how to maintain all this critical infrastructure and to keep a safe environment.
So building resilience does not just happen after a disaster, right? Ideally, we can do it also in non-conflict or non-disaster zones and get them prepared for it. What does it mean to be resilient, for a community to be resilient?
Well, exactly. This whole DRR or BRC thing is designed so that the community and the place is more prepared for a disaster. So ideally, it is a program that we should do before a disaster. Even for areas which are not prone to natural calamities or so-called natural disaster, but other kind of risks and threats, we should have this kind of programs as well,
So for the typical, I guess, listener or Klang Valley residents who are listening to this recording at the moment, what does it mean for them? How can they be prepared for disaster?
Take one example of urbanization. Urbanization comes in with a lot of other recent threats. For example, a flash flood or maybe urban poor, which then lead to other issues like mental health problems. They are very specific. So they are not... We can't just say that, oh, we are living in Kuala Lumpur, there's no earthquake, there's no big flood. But what about flash flood? What about uncontrolled development, which would lead to something else like landslide? Or what about the uncontrolled urbanization, which could lead to other economic and health and mental problems? So the BRC program should be able to cater for this kind of specific needs, specific contexts. And therefore, that is the reason why this BRC thing is quite dynamic in a way and very challenging, because we require a team and also approaches which are supposed to be very dynamic, supposed to be able to be adopted to all those requirements of a specific community.
At the moment, do you mostly react to something that's happening, or do you try to be proactive in identifying hotspots or areas that where you want to... you and your team go in and try to get the community ready and resilient for whatever that may come?
We do it both ways, of course. For example, like the recent disaster in Lombok and Laos, now we are looking into the possibility of offering the BRC program. Of course, there's a proactive measure to it. So now the government are more open, are more accessible. We have been approaching the state government of Selangor. We have been talking to the deputy prime minister to inculcate this whole idea of disaster risk reduction and disaster risk management to all level, which mean, ideally, our vision, if we can have this resilience building agenda being inculcated as wide as possible, that would be very ideal. Because the definition of resilience is a very complex term, but basically, just to make it easy for laymen like you and me, it is about the ability to bounce back as quick as possible to your normal condition. The quicker that you bounce back, the more resilient you are. I believe the people in Lombok has bounced back quite impressively quick. Maybe because of the cultural tradition of the Indonesian of being better prepared for disaster. When they learn a big lesson from this Indian Ocean tsunami. So I hope that we Malaysian also will have that ability to bounce back, because we have been learning from other disasters as well. Kelantan, Cameron Highland landslide, the Highland Tower.
Right, right. I mentioned earlier that you are trained as an architect. How did your path with the non-profit on humanitarian work cross?
Well, I was trained as an architect and I'm a practicing urban designer. And along the way, I could see that it is very much related. But how I started was one of my professor back then, who is the head of operation for the Aceh office during the Indonesian tsunami, called me to assist him, to assist Mercy Malaysia, because there's a house rebuilding program. So obviously you need an architect. So that is where my journey started in this humanitarian work, in this humanitarian sphere. But then, over the years, it has become very much clearer that things like development, things like strategic planning are very much aligned to humanitarian actions. And, for example, BRC, even though we train people not in... we train people to build resilience and to mitigate disaster not in a structured manner, meaning that not in building buildings, but it could also be that way. But the long-term thing, the expertise, the knowledge of an architect, of a town planner, of an of engineer of all fields, are much needed again, to complement the whole humanitarian action so that it could be sustainable in the long term.
When was this when you first went to over to Indonesia?
2015.
Yeah. And when did you start working with Mercy?
2015. Yeah. Because I'm an architecture nerd. I mean, that's the reason why I teach architecture, because I'm a nerd in architecture. When you are a nerd, you tend to love to discover more things. So architectural work within humanitarian field is quite new for me, at least for me. I mean, it's not new. I mean, people have been doing things back in the 70s and the 60s outside of Malaysia. But for a Malaysian, 2005, when you got an opportunity to practice architectural knowledge in the humanitarian field, that is something new. And that is how I start to have this interest.
So now you are still in the private sector. You're busy with urban designing. You're also lecturing, and you also devote a lot of time to Mercy. How do you manage your time?
I don't really manage my time. Because, well, of course, it's tough. It's a tough work. But you do it out of need, and you do it out of your interest. For me, personally, Mercy Malaysia is part of my personal ideology of serving humanity. Therefore, the sense of time has somehow diminished. Same like teaching, because if I don't teach, I'll go cuckoo. I mean, because the more you know, the more you need to share. So again, teaching is a necessity for me, same like Mercy Malaysia. And of course, the private sector work is for me to keep to be able to pay my bills.
You spoke of the linkage, how architecture and humanitarian work intersect. How does it inform, for you at least, how does what you do with Mercy inform what you do in the private sector and vice versa?
Architecture is about creating space. And everything, including humanitarian work, there are space, whether it is a tangible space or an intangible space. So by creating this space, so let's talk about the tangible space. By creating this tangible space, for example, a safer school, that, I mean, even though it looks like a very simple school, none of those that you would see in Singapore, in Putrajaya, all those nicely built schools, I mean, it is not about form, it is about the content of the thing that you are building. When you're creating this space, the impact is tremendous. Maybe you can't see it directly, but, for example, when disaster happens and that school is strong, standing, that is where the result of that knowledge, architecture and engineering knowledge, assists humanitarian action. A second example of creating space, for example, I'm a practicing urban designer. There are a lot of challenges and issues in urban context, in cities, due to lack of regulation, lack of creativity in land reform, land use reform, in land use planning. So, and these shortages are, if not major, are some of the reason why the world is being more open, susceptible to risks and threats. So, again, like myself, I have no choice but to use this knowledge in urban planning and urban design to help build a more resilient and sustainable place or world.
Coming back to the Triple Nexus before we close the show. So it's a relatively new vision, right? 2016, you mentioned. In the process of getting there, how do we turn this debate away from it getting too theoretical and making it more practical?
Well, I always mention to my colleagues at Mercy Malaysia and the whole humanitarian sector will only survive not because of money or because of our volunteers. Not only because of that. I mean, those two are important. But because of our creativity. So even though it is something new, the triple nexus, through creativity, it is something that is possible to be done. Proper planning and good assessment, which would lead to good program design, will help to get this triple nexus vision real. Because there's no use of, it's not that smart if you keep on giving humanitarian aid without allowing the community to build their own capacity so that it can move forward. That is one form of development. And when they are well developed, when they are more sustainably developed, they live in a peaceful coexistence. Of course, the details are a lot and they are very dynamic because each one of them are interdependent and also they're depending on each specificity of the context. But through that proper process of getting from humanitarian aid into development would hopefully resulted in a more peaceful, safer environment, living environment.
Hafiz Amiru, thank you so much for speaking to me today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.